This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll hear from the author of a new book on how some Illinois towns got their names. Also, how one community reacted to recent news that could mean the end of a major employer. Illinois' recreational marijuana sales did better than expected in the first year, even with a pandemic.
People certainly have been at home and out of work in a lot of cases, so they've had more time to use it. So it's certainly a pandemic-proof product.
What's ahead for marijuana in Illinois? We'll learn more about a mental health crisis clinic. And you may not realize it, but there was a time when there were slaves in Illinois. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll learn about a mental health crisis clinic in central Illinois. We'll also reflect on the state's first year of recreational marijuana sales and what the future could bring. And we'll remember a dark chapter for Illinois when slavery was in the land of Lincoln. That and more on the way on Statewide. Well, a new book chronicles more than 100 Illinois communities and how they got their names, along with early history about the Prairie State. Jennifer Fuller of WSIU talked with the book's author, Laurent Prino.
You know, I love this state. I think we're, in many ways, you know, people on the coast think of us as a flyover state. And then, frankly, people in lots of parts of Illinois think of us as just a drive-through state, that you drive through to get to somewhere else. And I have found just some charming places. But I think it all starts with a joke. Years and years ago, a teacher of mine said, "You're French." And she said, "Oh, I'm from Paris." And I was like, "Oh, that's great." I started speaking to her in French. She's like, "No, Paris, Illinois." So, and I was like, "Wait, there's a Paris, Illinois." I think it was just one of those things. You know, I grew up on the Swiss border in France, and my parents are French. Most people in my family for generations were French. And I had a Swiss grandmother, but it would never occur to me to call myself Swiss, even though I grew up like a short stroll from the Swiss border. And it was really an amazing lesson to have Americans introduce themselves to me, you know, saying they're French, because we stay so rooted to, we love Illinois, we love the US, but we stay so rooted to where we came from. And I think that became evident, you know, in Europe, you don't have places named after foreign places. You just have place names. And the fact that we have all these wonderful places with these exotic names was just so alluring. I said, I got to check it out, you know? And I did learn a thing or two when I asked for directions to Vienna instead of Vienna. And, you know, most of the names at the end of the day came from people who just thought they were exotic and fun. And that's probably why the pronunciation got lost. But there's a lot of places where truly they're rooted in the history of that country, because it was named by immigrants from that country a lot of times. And so sometimes the pronunciation has gotten a little creative over the years, but many of the towns are very much keeping the culture alive in their towns that the country is named after, which is fun. And by the way, sometimes they're honoring a culture that the town wasn't really named after, but it's just fun. So it's been a pleasure discovering all these towns all these years.
Do you find that there's a reckoning at all as people really start to look at the roots of a region and they say, well, you know, particularly say in southwestern Illinois, where you find so much French influence along the river there, but that they're also having to deal with the fact that the French moved into an area where an indigenous people had already settled and already created one of the larger ancient civilizations in this part of the world. Is there a reckoning there? Is there something that people either are recognizing or need to?
I think kind of need to. You know, having grown up in France, I learned French history, but you know, we never learned how violent we were to indigenous people. We certainly, it wasn't until I drove to Southern Illinois and I went to Fort Deschartes and some of the other towns and St. Genevieve across the way and that I realized that the French had introduced slavery here. You know, that's something that we often forget about as a state. And obviously, you know, there's just heartbreak throughout the stories of most of these towns. I mean, just how hard their life was for the settlers, just how violent it was, how many settlers got massacred, entire families, entire settlements. But while sometimes, you know, there's a plaque remembering that, there's no plaque remembering that the reason that happened is because we destroyed the village of the, you know, the indigenous people who lived there before, may have killed some of them, may have desecrated the grounds where they had buried their ancestors. So it's a very complex, fraught, and violent history. And I think it helps us to understand it. And I think being the land of Lincoln, all these years, which we deserve, and you know, just about every town has a Lincoln sighting, which is kind of fun. Sometimes they're made up. Being the land of Lincoln, I think we've in a way kind of given ourselves a pass on a lot of things that took place when in fact early governors of the state and other state leaders enslaved people. There were lynchings in the state well into the 20th century that went unaddressed and unpunished. And so, you know, but at the same time, I think we need to be careful to still paint a balanced history. I think a lot of the settlers came and obviously benefited, and some of them took part in the eradication of the indigenous culture. And we need to be more honest and forthright about that. But at the same time, there's just amazing histories. And going back to the names, the people came here. I think they wanted to honor where they came from with these names, you know, or they were dreaming of big things. I think that's why a town like Thebes gets its name, because we're dreaming that we're creating these new cities that are going to rival those of ancient history.
Laurent Pernot is the author of There and Here, Small Illinois Towns with Big Names. I'm Jennifer Fuller.
There are concerns in a northern Illinois community that it could lose a major employer, which also contributes heavily to the property tax base. Exelon has announced plans to retire the Byron Nuclear Generating Station, located about 90 miles west of Chicago. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco has more on the reaction.
So, at the end of August, Ashley McGarry heard that Exelon Generation planned to retire the Byron Power Plant, but it wasn't exactly news to McGarry. She's from Byron, and for her, it's more of a headline that gets recycled every couple of years.
I mean, this has been a cycle of, you know, news for years and years and years. It's always, oh, the plant's going to close. I mean, and it seems like in more recent years, it's been more regularly stated that the plant's going to close, you know? And then as soon as that announcement is made, another announcement comes out that they're like having their best year ever.
McGarry's a second grade teacher at Mary Morgan Elementary and also the union president of the local teachers union, the Byron Education Association. So after the announcement, she says she started getting the usual worried calls and thought to herself.
So, you know, we've been here before. We've heard this before. I don't think that it was anything that even caught my attention at first.
But then there were more calls. And soon a worker at the power plant, one of McGarry's former high school classmates, called her and said things were more serious.
I mean, before there was even a second to hesitate or a second to worry, there were people on it. You know, people were already formulating plans.
The official announcement from Exelon promised to shutter not just the Byron Nuclear Power Plant, but also another near Morris, Illinois, just southwest of Chicago. Together, that would mean powering down four nuclear generation units that provide zero emission energy to some 4 million homes and businesses across northern Illinois. The Byron Station would shut down by September 2021, and Dresden would follow behind it before the end of the year. And although the facility is licensed to operate for two more decades, Exelon cited current regulations and competition with fossil fuels as giving them no option but to retire the plant prematurely. The announcement came on the heels of a federal investigation into a bribery scheme in which ComEd, a subsidiary of Exelon, exchanged jobs and contracts for legislative influence with the Illinois Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan. Earlier this summer, ComEd agreed to a deferred prosecution and paid a $200 million penalty. Buster Barton, the superintendent of the Byron School District, called McGarry too. She said there was no time for any kind of doom and gloom to even set in.
At first, I didn't take it super seriously. And then by the time that I was like, oh, maybe I need to pay a second glance or give this a second glance, there were already people coming at me with, we're going to do this and we're going to do this and we're going to do this. And I'm like, okay, there's a plan in place. People have, action going in the right direction.
Not long after the news hit, Barton and the school board and some other community leaders formed the Byron Station Response Committee. The group's goal was to start mobilizing the community around saving the plant and pushing legislators in Springfield to vote in favor of saving the plant. For Barton, it's hard to overstate the kind of crater the power plant would leave behind in terms of lost tax dollars.
Yeah, almost $0.75. So approximately 74% of our revenue comes from that plant.
And he says that's just for the school district, but that the 75% funding figure is more or less consistent with the rest of the local taxing districts too, which includes the fire department, the parks department, and the police department. An economic impact report recently released by Northern Illinois University reported that closing the power station would cost the region over 2,000 jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars annually. And for Barton, losing the power plant would also be a huge loss for clean energy in Illinois.
You know, that plant not only offers clean energy in terms of not burning carbon, but it's also very, very, very reliable. You know, I think our plant is online about 97% of the time. It's very reliable.
McGarry agrees. She says that sure, maybe the district loses some local tax dollars, but that in the long run, the district will be okay. It's the loss of the nuclear energy that she thinks is the real shame.
Getting rid of that plant will really increase our need for, you know, other types of resources that are carbon emitting, that are using our natural resources. And that's really, I think that's really the doom and gloom of it all. Not really from a, you know, school funding perspective or programming perspective.
What's more, in Illinois, the state prioritizes funding for schools with the least percentage of local revenue and guarantees that they get at least the same amount of funding that they did the year before. And due to concern about the plant closing one day, the Byron School Board moved a lot of money around towards keeping reserve. So for McGarry, it's the workers at the plant and everyone else that relies on it that she's worried about.
We're the ultimate doomsday preppers. They should make an HGTV show or Discovery Channel show about us.
But she says that no matter what, people in Byron will be okay. This whole scenario has played out in the back of their minds for years. I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
Well, a year ago this fall, the former Sangamon County Sheriff Wes Barr died of a heart attack, and that came as a shock to his family because he never showed symptoms of a heart problem. Later, his family realized they'd missed a sign that something was wrong. I had a chance to talk with his wife, Sherry, who is using her husband's death to raise awareness and help others. Going back to that day, how did you find out about what happened?
He was at my nephew's shop. And he was cleaning his boat. My nephew was out with his crew on a job site. They had one of his employees had come back and found Wes, called 911, called my nephew, and my nephew called me.
He had had health concerns before, but not regarding the heart, correct? That was a surprise to you.
It was a total surprise. Wes was actually really healthy. He had high blood pressure, but he'd had it for years. With never any issues or problems with it. As a matter of fact, he was on two medications. The doctor had taken him off of one because he was doing so well. He had gone to the dentist shortly after that. Our dentist takes blood pressure and said, hey, your blood pressure's a little high. And he said, okay. So he, of course, we just assumed that it was because we had just been taken off of one medication. So the doctor put him back on it. Thought everything was fine, and shortly after, he had the heart attack.
There were some indicators, but you feel they were missed, correct?
Yeah. Afterwards, we thought about it. We were talking about, like, because everybody kept saying he had no signs. And I said, you know what? He did have. For about a month, he had indigestion. And we didn't realize that that was a sign. He was 56, and we just... You know, people around had indigestion. I actually had an incident where I thought, and he told me to go get it checked, and I went to get it checked, and it was indigestion. So when he got it, we just thought, oh, it's indigestion.
Now, what have people told you since then regarding that?
Well, we've learned that indigestion is a sign, you know. We thought that it was really the other way around, that and when you thought it was your heart, it was end-up indigestion. We didn't realize that indigestion really was a sign that it is your heart.
He did not have anything like shortness of breath or, you know, chest pains, things like
that? Nothing. He had nothing. This was a complete shock.
I read where you had also, by promoting this, by talking to people that you know, encouraged others who were feeling similar symptoms to go and get checked out, and that proved to be fortuitous to them, apparently.
I had just been talking about Wes's head indigestion and that this is a sign. And I had been posting on my Facebook page and just telling people that this is a sign. So one of the guys is a dear friend of ours at the lake, and he went to work that day, and he thought, man, I got indigestion. He had a couple of days, and he thought, you know, and he got to work, and he thought, you know what? I just don't feel right. I don't feel bad. But he said he remembered what happened to Wes, and he remembered me talking about indigestion. He turned around and went back to the hospital, and he had 90% blockage.
After your husband's passing, you decided to, you know, become more public about these types of symptoms, and then also you've decided to create a not-for-profit in his name.
I did. So, you know, Wes was so giving and caring, and he just loved this community so much, and he loved to volunteer and help people. And so he just left us way too soon, and I felt like it was my responsibility as his wife to keep his goodness going. I started the Heart of Wes Barr Foundation. I have a board of 12 of us total. Our goal is to raise money to help social service agencies, law enforcement, veterans associations, and animal protection. We'll help them, and we'll try to keep as much as possible the money in Sangamon County as well.
What do you think his reaction to that would be? I mean, the fact that giving back to the community this way.
Wes would love that. I mean, that's just what Wes lived for, and he would love that. And I always say, you know, when I get to heaven, I want my Savior to say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And I want my husband to say, "I'm so proud of you."
That's Sherry Barr. Her husband, Wes, was the former Sangamon County Sheriff, and he died of a heart attack a year ago this past fall. You can find out more details about their nonprofit organization. There's a link at the website at statewideshow.com. A reminder, you can follow us on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. You can keep up with the program each week and be among the first to know when a new episode is available. Again, that's on Facebook. Look for Statewide Show. We have more to come. What One Health System is doing to help with what some have called a mental health crisis. That's on the way. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Some emergency rooms have reported seeing a surge of patients in mental health crisis during the pandemic. Among them is Memorial Health, which operates 5 hospitals across central Illinois. And to meet the need, the health system's behavioral health affiliate launched a mental health crisis clinic. Memorial Behavioral Health President Diana Nabe spoke with Illinois Newsroom's Christine Herman about how they hope to help people in crisis while keeping them out of the ER.
As we looked at the data over the last couple of years, about 2/3 of the persons that present at the emergency rooms for behavioral health reasons ended up not being admitted to an inpatient unit anywhere. And lots of times we're checking all over the state trying to find places for folks, especially children, because there aren't as many children in patient behavioral health anymore in the state. And so we wanted to be able to offer an alternative to individuals who often are deflected. So I likened it to kind of being that acute care or express care kind of response for physical health issues. So for people who, you know, are feeling like they're in crisis, but they may not be at the point where they would meet criteria for inpatient admission, don't appear to also have any kind of medical issues.
So you want to reduce the patient's risk of exposure to the virus and also not occupy space in the ER that could be used for other people.
Yeah, you got it. I know, Christine, the other thing that was coming out, and it's probably been within the last month, I think, that we were all a little surprised by, but in some ways not, those individuals that have been inpatient and COVID positive are being found to actually have more episodes of anxiety and depression within the first 90 days of discharge. And again, if you kind of think about it from the standpoint of kind of trauma, and many of these folks are there in the hospital by themselves, may not know, and many have, you know, I think continuing medical issues as a result of COVID. And then again, I think some of the isolation and stigma related to COVID. And if they've had any sort of intubation or anything along that line, I think that in and of itself can be fairly traumatic. And so, you know, am I going to get it again? What, you know, all of those kinds of things. So it does make sense from that standpoint that there are certainly people at more risk. So we've been trying to get the word out to our fellow, you know, healthcare providers to be on the lookout for people who have been COVID positive and have, especially those that have been inpatient, that they may need a behavioral health referral.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts too on just, you know, I've been learning, obviously there's a growing need for mental health services during this time. It's also a time when a lot of state and local revenues are down because of the economic fallout of the pandemic. And I just wonder if it concerns you that, you know, resources are going to be strained at a time when the need has never been greater.
Yeah, I think that certainly is a concern. Obviously, Illinois, you know, had all kinds of financial issues to begin with. It sounds like, you know, we're on the brink potentially of more, especially related to human services. So I think that is a real concern, a real valid concern for folks. And so, you know, I think for us not being, you know, being affiliated with a health system is helpful, because, you know, they've got diversification as far as funding bases and those kinds of things. So that gives us a little bit more protection than a standalone community mental health center who gets a lot of their funds from Medicaid, Medicare, and from, you know, grants. And so, you know, again, we're looking at how we can make sure that we're partnering with our healthcare providers and offering alternatives so that we're not burdening the hospital and the emergency rooms even more.
That's Diana Nabe. She is president of Memorial Behavioral Health, and she spoke with Christine Herman. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide, you can contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number is 1-800-273-TALK. It's been a tough year for essential workers, nurses, first responders, grocery store employees. But among the hardest hit are agricultural workers who have been working nonstop to keep food on our tables and yet struggling to make ends meet themselves. Alexandra Sosa is the executive director of the Farm Worker and Landscaper Advocacy Project. The organization provides financial and educational resources to low-income immigrant families. Dana Cronin spoke with Sosa about how the pandemic has taken a toll on this often invisible community.
A lot of the folks you work with are essential workers, many of whom I assume have continued working despite the risks. What have you been hearing from them in this year of COVID-19?
So there is a huge need in the community, in the Latin community. They are not able, those who work in the food industry at the factories processing food are not able to keep the social distance. And that's one of the reasons, because they got infected and increased like the Latin community numbers in terms of COVID infections. They are not able to keep the social distance. They are not getting proper equipment by the company owners. Like they are not getting, for example, face mask and in general, the protected equipment that they should be getting. And also because this is people who make less than minimum wage sometimes, they need a lot of financial assistance to support their family.
Have there been any specific stories or situations that have really stuck with you this year?
Well, we have several, but one, for example, is I was in the field and then I saw a worker on the street doing landscaping work, and he was with his kid, and his kid was helping him. His kid was around 8 years old, Alex. So I stopped and I told his dad that after I did a short intake, like how things are going during the pandemic, how many hours he was working, and then I figured out that he was behind on rent for too many months. So I told him we can give you a check for $500 that you can go and catch and at least pay part of the rent and buy some food. And he was very happy with the help. So I asked Alex, I said, Alex, what do you want to do with the money? What are you going to do with the money? And then Alex said, I want to buy ice cream. And I was like, wow, ice cream, of course. It has been like 7 months without having ice cream. And then he said, yes, and I also want my mother not to argue with the landlord because we don't have money to pay for rent.
Wow, yeah. And we know that agricultural workers have been hit hard by this pandemic, whether they work in a meatpacking plant or they're in a migrant farm worker camp. Why are they particularly vulnerable?
Well, it's because they are essential workers. They cannot take a break. They cannot work from home. They cannot have Zoom meetings as we do. And they are in the field producing the food that we put on our table, that we have every day, that we go to the grocery store and we have enough groceries to buy. They risking their lives in the field to make possible that we have food on our table, that we can cover basic needs.
That's Dana Cronin talking with Alexandra Sosa, Executive Director of the Farm Worker and Landscaper Advocacy Project. Sosa says her organization has distributed over $1.5 million this year to Illinois families in need, and her waiting list still has about 1,200 people on it. The Chicago Tribune reporter Bob McCoppin covers issues related to marijuana. And January 1st marks the first-year anniversary of the legalization of adult-use cannabis in Illinois. He spoke with our reporter Maureen McKinney about the problems meeting social equity aims in the legislation and what is likely to come next.
What happened with revenue? Was there more or less than expected? I heard that it nearly exceeded alcohol tax revenue.
I know it was a pleasant surprise for the state of Illinois because the cannabis kept setting monthly records almost every month as far as sales, and it's taxed at a high rate. So it was one of the few sources of extra revenue this year during the pandemic.
Has COVID helped or hurt the sales, do you think?
I think that we've seen more people buying cannabis instead of alcohol in some cases. So, and people certainly have been at home and out of work in a lot of cases, so they've had more time to use it. So it's certainly a pandemic-proof product. But I think most forecasts are for sales to get much bigger in the future as the market matures and more people try it.
There's been a lot going on with the social equity piece. Can you bring us up to speed?
The social equity piece has been the biggest disappointment of legalization in Illinois so far. The governor and the lawmakers had boasted of Illinois having the best social equity aspect of their law, which was meant to give investment opportunities to minorities who had been the most affected by the war on drugs through disproportionate rates of arrests and convictions. But the main way they were going to do that was to give out new licenses, medical growing and dispensary licenses to applicants. But none of those licenses have been given out so far because they've gotten caught in a mess over their scoring. And some people were supposed to be notified, all the applicants were to be notified of problems, deficiencies with their applications. And some said they never got those notices and weren't able to correct them. There's been complaints that people who did score well, were politically connected or had a lot of money and were, again, a lot of the white wealthy investors that already dominate the market. So now the Pritzker administration is trying to go back and rescore all the applications, but it's gotten delayed for months, and everybody who applied is losing tens of thousands of dollars trying to hold on to real estate, waiting to see if they'll even be able to open a marijuana business here.
Do you have any sense of when there might be a decision on that?
They have not said. They said in the fall, they said it was coming soon, and then they ran into these problems with the scoring, and now they won't say when it's coming. So we're hoping early in 2021.
Marijuana is your primary beat, right?
Yes.
And what's been most surprising to you?
The most surprising thing about the beat, I guess, has to be the failure to award the new licenses to new business applicants. That was, you know, the star of the show. It was supposed to be the most important aspect of the program, and it's just totally gotten caught in a log jam. So the administration will have to figure out, and now they're caught between a rock and a hard place, because the people who scored perfectly and qualified for a lottery to win licenses are suing, and people who say they were unfairly scored were suing previously. So it's difficult to make everybody happy, but they may have to do a first round under the original rules and then a subsequent round to give more people a shot at these valuable licenses.
The social equity piece made Illinois different than other states doing it by referendum?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, other states, you know, generally just held referenda that which the voters approved legalization, and then left it to the lawmakers to work out the details. In this case, Illinois, it's the lawmakers made it almost impossible to hold a referendum on issues like this in our state. So the lawmakers retain control over the process from start to finish, and they laid out all the details of it, and they tried to put in provisions to help people who'd been hurt by the war on drugs before, but it's just been difficult to roll them out, and one big problem has been that basically the program started as an expansion of the medical marijuana program, and they just let the companies who already had medical licenses start selling recreational marijuana also. And so all the newcomers have been frozen out. None of the newcomers have gotten licenses. So only the 21 companies that own the original, or people that own the 21 original medical licenses are making money off of growing this cannabis. New applicants who won so far, the new applicants who got perfect scores and qualified for the lottery to win a license, have a suit pending now, and a decision may be imminent at any time, as to they're just trying to get the governor to force the governor to award the licenses to the people who have qualified already.
What do you think is next in the situation?
Well, they're going to have to try to fix the situation. Like I say, either they could try to do two rounds of awarding licenses. They could award licenses to the people who qualified already, and then go on to a second round for people who say they were unfairly scored. And then there will be subsequent rounds of licenses awarded in next year and in the year following. But they need to get something going as soon as possible to get these new licenses out there.
Am I remembering right, there are 75 licenses?
Well, there are 75 dispensary licenses for individual dispensaries. And then there are also 40 craft grower licenses that will be coming out, and transporter licenses and infuser licenses. So all those are waiting to be awarded. And of course, you know, this is just for people who favor the program. Obviously, there remain a contingent of parents and others who oppose the legalization and commercialization of cannabis.
That's Chicago Tribune reporter Bob McCoppin, and he spoke with Maureen McKinney. Well, stick around. There is still more to come on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Remember to check our website each week, statewideshow.com. You can find links to the stories you hear on each episode. Well, up next, because Illinois is a northern state and the home of Abraham Lincoln, it's not typically associated with slavery. But it did happen here for more than a century, even when Lincoln was serving as president. Jamie Dunn talked with the author Tara McClellan McAndrew about Illinois' often unknown history of slavery.
Slavery came to Illinois pretty darn early. It was while the French owned our land, and it was part of the Louisiana Territory. A French businessman named Philippe Francis Renault brought 500 slaves from the Dominican Republic to develop a mine here near where Prairie du Rocher is now in southwestern Illinois. The mine did not succeed, so after a couple decades or so, Renault sold the slaves to residents and he left.
And Illinois' slave population grew from the time it was a territory to the time after it became a state. How much did it grow and what were some of the reasons for that?
Illinois' slave population really boomed from the time that it was a territory until about the mid-1800s. In 1810, according to the federal census, and this is when we were still a territory, we became a state in 1818. In 1810, Illinois had 168 slaves. In 1845, that number was nearly 5,000. A lot of the people who first settled Illinois settled in the South and tended to be from the southern states, which were slave-owning states. Many of them, as a result, had sympathies with that attitude and often had slaves themselves. They wanted to bring their slaves here with them. As Illinois was developing, the people here, of course, wanted to continue to develop and draw new settlers. And they realized that in order to do that, they had to draw from some of the states that were southern and also own slaves, and if people didn't know if they could bring their slaves here or not, they might not want to come here. There's a very interesting writing by a man named N. Dwight Harris, and he wrote a book in the very early 1900s about slavery in Illinois, and he talked about some of the other reasons that our state was pro-slavery in its territory days and its early days as a state. So according to Harris's book, some of the other reasons that Illinois was essentially pro-slavery included settlers who were here believed that they needed slave help to settle the land. This is a really interesting next reason. They thought that having slaves here in Illinois would help disperse the slave population around the nation and thereby decrease the chance of having a slave revolt. But the last reason is my favorite, and it really involves some very creative thinking. Here's what he wrote. Quote, "Slavery here would provide the colored people with a partial escape from the servitude of the South by the possibility of a transfer to the lighter indentured servitude system of Illinois, and thereby be an inestimable blessing to blacks." Oh, the really creative thinking is just mind-boggling, but creative thinking is evident throughout our first state constitution and some of the constitutions that followed afterward. And what I mean by that is they practiced George Orwellian doublethink. I don't know if you remember the George Orwell book 1984, but they talked about the concept of doublethink, which is the process of holding two contradictory thoughts simultaneously and believing in them. Our state constitution did that, our first one, by both outlawing and allowing slavery. In order to gain statehood, Congress mandated that Illinois become a free state. but we already had French slaves that were owned by some of the residents. We had Southern settlers who wanted to keep their slaves. The framers of our first Constitution had to walk a fine line. They basically stated that slavery would not be introduced into this state, but existing slaves could still remain slaves, and those who were indentured servants would have to fill out the remainders of their contracts, and that that would somehow be legal under this very contradictory document.
And what were some of the stances that Illinois politicians took on slavery?
Our territorial governor, Ninian Edwards, was pro-slavery. He was from the South. He owned slaves. And so he helped interpret some of our early laws and believed that, yes, our constitution, our territorial constitution, will still let us basically have slaves. Our first governor was also pro-slavery. Our second governor was not. Our third and our fourth were pro-slavery as well. So while Illinois had leaders who were pro-slavery, of course, our laws reflected that. Our second governor, Governor Edward Coles, was an anomaly in terms of our first state leaders who were largely pro-slavery. Coles was not, even though he came from a slaveholding state and inherited slaves from his father. In fact, he brought them to Illinois, where he freed them against the law. And during his inaugural address, he called for the abolition of slavery in Illinois. He called for laws that would prevent the kidnapping of free blacks and runaway slaves in Illinois. And he also called for a constitution which would put these things into law. For his anti-slavery attitudes and efforts, Coles basically lost all political power after his term as governor ended, and he ended up leaving the state.
And then your story also touches on an abolitionist who lost his life over the cause, Elijah Lovejoy. Can you tell me just a little bit about him?
Even though Illinois was largely pro-slavery in its early decades as a state, even from the beginning, we did have people who were anti-slavery and some who were out-and-out abolitionists. And one of those, one of the more well-known ones, was a printer named Elijah Lovejoy, who lived in Alton in 1837 and printed an anti-slavery newspaper. And unfortunately, because of his stance, he lost his life. A pro-slavery mob attacked him in Alton, destroyed his printer, and killed him.
Former slaves who had escaped to the North and free blacks in Illinois still had to worry about kidnapping. Why was that?
Not only was Illinois mostly pro-slavery in its earliest decades, but some of our citizens took it a step further, and we basically had what some people call a reverse underground railroad. One of our laws basically kind of encouraged that attitude. An 1819 state law mandated that citizens interrogate blacks to determine if they were free or if they were runaway slaves. And if they were the latter, the white interrogator got money for it. I think it was $10. Some took that further, especially some folks who were fervently pro-slavery and anti-black who lived in southern Illinois. Some of those folks would actually kidnap runaway slaves and even free blacks who possibly didn't have their freedom papers with them, and they would return them to the South where they would make money from their sale. According to a relatively new book by a man named Daryl Dexter and called Bondage in Egypt, which is about slavery in Southern Illinois, some of these kidnappers were so bold that they would actually go up to the homes of free blacks and kidnap their children. It said, his book says that black children were especially at the greatest risk of being kidnapped by slave catchers and taken back down to the South and sold back into slavery or into slavery for the first time.
Your story talks about something called the Black Codes. Can you tell me what the Black Codes were?
The Black Codes were laws that Illinois passed over its earliest decades as a state, which basically served as a way to tell all African Americans, free or runaway slaves, don't come here. Don't come here. Don't settle here. It was our unwelcome sign. as we grew older as a new state, those black codes only worsened and became harsher. For instance, some of the black codes prevented blacks from being in Illinois for more than 10 days, or they could be arrested, fined, and auctioned off. Free blacks and their children had to prove they were free by showing certificates of freedom with their county seat shortly after their arrival. Slaves or servants had to have written permission to go farther than 10 miles from their master's homestead or risk being whipped. Blacks could not gather in groups of three or more to make revelry or dance, or they could be whipped. And to add to this, blacks could not serve in the militia, could not vote, and could not testify in court. And the latter two, of course, prevented them from having any power to change their status as powerless.
How does Illinois' history of slavery compare with other northern states, with some of our neighbors?
Illinois wasn't the only northern state that had slavery, although we appear in some ways to have perhaps among the worst records of it. Indiana became a state 2 years earlier than Illinois did, and its first constitution outlawed slavery, like ours did. However, like our first constitution, Indiana's also condoned indentured servitude for a few decades. And when Illinois became a state 2 years later, we basically borrowed that part of Indiana's constitution, which outlawed slavery and yet allowed indentured servitude. According to an historian, Christopher Lehman, who studied Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, or the Upper Mississippi Valley states, he studied slavery in this region, our constitution, compared to those other states, was the only one that allowed slavery and indentured servitude. Wisconsin followed the lead of Illinois and did let slaves work in its mines, but eventually that stopped around the 1830s. What it sounds like some other northern states did was say, we're not going to allow slavery, but we're also not going to allow any blacks in our communities. And we didn't quite go that far, but we got awfully close because of our black laws.
I'm sure you talk with folks about Illinois history fairly frequently. How often do you find that people are surprised by Illinois' slave history?
I find that people are surprised when they learn that Illinois had slaves all the time. In fact, some of the historians I interviewed about slavery in Illinois, at least two of them told me that they didn't know Illinois had slaves until they were working on their undergraduate or graduate degrees in history. I think that says a lot. Your average person probably has no idea that Illinois really was a quasi-slave state. How many of us think of the home or the hometown? Springfield even had a slave auction. Abraham Lincoln's relatives, some of his relatives by marriage, who lived here, owned slaves. It's hard to believe. We're always lauded, especially in Illinois, as a free state, the home of the emancipator. But we weren't, and we weren't for a long time, from approximately 1719 until about 1863 or 1865. We had slaves. You can look at our newspapers around the state. We had ads selling slaves. We had ads for slave catcher services. It's there.
Why do you think it's important for people today to understand this part of our state's history?
Number one, just because it's the truth. We have to face the truth, no matter how ugly or unwanted. And I am not an expert on this, but I personally believe that that history, as all history does, has to affect us today. It happened. It has to have affected how we act as a community, as an estate today. There's one more thing I want to say about this. Some people think that because slavery existed in the North, it might have been a lighter version, you know, slavery light, if you will. But some of the historians that I talked to or whose books I read said that it could be the treatments of slaves could be just as harsh as it was in the South. Just like in the South, some of them were sexually abused. Just like in the South, some of them were punished severely and whipped, One slave who tried to kill his master was sentenced to be whipped over 3 days. It wasn't necessarily slavery light.
That's author Tara McClellan McAndrew speaking with Jamie Dunn about the Illinois history of slavery. You can read more with a link at our website. That's it for this episode of Statewide. We're glad you could join us and be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this show or past shows, you can find them all at statewideshow.com. Our weekly podcast is also available through the NPR One app. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. We hope your new year is off to a good start. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.